Welcome, everyone. Ideally, in a perfect world, I'd like to do a little bit of narrative about my life, but then kind of open it up for more of a discussion. So if you guys will indulge me on that and ask me questions so I don't sit up here awkwardly silent, that'd be great. So just kind of give like a narrative, kind of chronicle of my life and kind of how it led me to practice and stuff. So I was born in Utah, and kind of my earliest memories are of mountains and, you know, wide open spaces. And I think that kind of set a very early template of, you know, I feel most at home in the mountains. And I, you know, just forests and mountains. And I remember being a kid and thinking the mountains were made of steel. And I'm like, asked my parents, are mountains made of steel? And they're like, yes. And I believed that until I was like 12. You know, so I try not to do that kind of stuff to my kids. And then, you know, we moved to the Washington, D.C., Maryland area when I was like 5 and 6. And I lived there until I was like 14. Then moved to Southern California. I grew up totally non-religious. You know, I don't have a memory of this, but my mom says I went to Sunday school at one point, but I asked so many questions, they disinvited me. And I remember having a concept of God as a kid of this, like, it's really weird why I thought this, like a giant human, naked, fat, like living in a cave underground, like pulling levers, like controlling the world. And then it dawned on me, like, I hate that, just, it would be too many levers, you know? And I thought, you know, there's probably not a God. This is probably, you know, not true, you know? And so, you know, I grew up through my teenager years and stuff, just not, you know, thinking, you know, just seeing the world in a very materialistic, you know, mechanistic, non-spiritual, you know, and I was kicked out of the Cub Scouts because I didn't believe in God. I got kicked out of a gifted program in elementary school and a public school because I admitted I didn't believe in God. And, yeah, believe it or not, yeah. No, this was in Maryland. You know, in theory, it was the best school district in the country. It was a public school, yeah. I mean, she didn't say it so much, but there was a clear before and after in how she acted to me when I made that public pronouncement in class, you know. And so when I was like 14, my dad got a job in California. So we moved out from Maryland, which was very lush, and I spent most of my free time in the woods, you know, to Southern California, which, you know, I thought it would be like a lush jungle, you know, based on the TV shows, but it was a desert and everything was manicured. And I thought the people were very plastic and, you know, not sincere people. And I kind of, the people that I kind of like got to know were kind of like the stoner skaters. They kind of like counterculture-ish. I kind of felt most comfortable with them. And I kind of skipped school a lot to hang out in the tunnels underneath school. And then I was invited to join what they told me was a continuation school. Turned out it was a school for dropouts and drug addicts and gang people. And my first day there, the principal looked at me and says, "You don't belong here." And I lasted there until, and then like in 10th grade, my parents sent me to live with my grandma in Sun Valley, Idaho. And I went to a private school there, I guess, in an attempt to save me. And I got kicked out of there for, a bunch of us brought pot to a camping trip, but I was the only one kicked out. And, it's because the other person was the headmaster's son. And then, but you know, I kind of had, my first experience with what I would call spirituality there in Idaho. I had, gone out partying with my friends the night before, and I ingested, I guess what could be called a psychotropic chemical. And, and the next morning, I was scheduled to go cross-country skiing with my grandma. And I'm pretty sure she thought something was wrong with me that morning. But we went cross-country skiing. And I remember we were in the lobby of this place, and I was, you know, still. And I was walking from kind of room, you know, I went from, like, the dining room to the rental shop. And I passed this little radio that was sitting on a like a shelf, and this music was just grabbed me, and it just sounded like ancient and like fragile and powerful and just timeless, like just, you know, and it stopped me on my track. And I looked at like kind of the hippie that was working there in the rental shop. I'm like, what is this? You know, it just totally blew my mind. And I mean, I'd heard other music that, you know, I'd gone from one room with music to another room with music and to this room with this music. I'm like, what is this? And he said, what's the Jerry Garcia Band? I'm like, oh. And in a, yeah, he's the guitarist of the Grateful Dead. And you know, I kind of, you know, thought a lot about this over the years. And I think, you know, so we have our senses, right? You know, we have sight, smell, taste, touch, no eyes, no ears, and all that good stuff. But I really, truly believe humans have another sense, and that's like for the mystical or spiritual. And I think that's the first time I experienced it in my life, or at least, you know, to that power. Like, I'd always been, when I was a little kid, I was really drawn to, like, fantasy stuff, like Dungeons and Dragons, Lord of the Rings, Hobbit, Smurfs even, you know. There's something about that magicalness. I think that was actually kind of that coming into play a little bit in my life, you know. I was really drawn to, like, just fantasy magic. But this is the first time, like, whoa. And so I started getting, like, really into the Grateful Dead and listening to their music. And then, you know, I think the experiment to save me in Idaho didn't work, so I moved back to California. And then I was able to start going to Grateful Dead concerts, and because, you know, all my friends were into it. And at first, it was just, you know, maybe the first five or six Grateful Dead concerts I saw, I didn't kind of tune into that, whatever that was I experienced in that room again. It was just this wonderful spectacle of thousands of people, tie-dyes, and just this huge tribal, just intense scene. I mean, it was just, you know, I loved it. And, but, you know, the music was just, it didn't really draw me. But there was one day. It was in December 1989. I was in the Los Angeles Forum, and it was before the show started. And I was, you know, kind of an entheogenic chemical state of mind. And I was sitting there in the seats, you know, before the concert start, and, you know, everyone's kind of pouring into the stadium, and I could just feel like some energy building. And I was like staring at the stage, and then I noticed that the stage was kind of the source of the energy. And then it was like, it's getting more, and just the stage was just, I mean, the house lights were still on and everything. And just the stage was really intense, and the energy was building and building, and boom, the lights go out. Just at the crescendo of the energy. And it was, you know, there's just, you know, everyone's like, yeah. And, you know, and then the band comes on stage, and just the energy is just so intense. And then they start playing, and it's just, and the music like fit together in a way that I'd never heard music even come, and I've always loved music, so it's been incredibly powerful in my life. But this was that, you know, if my previous experience in music was a 3 or 4, this was like 7 trillion, you know. And like the best analogy I can give to the Grateful Dead is, like, you know, remember for a while there were these little dots, like multicolored dots in the pictures, and it's just looks like chaos dots. But if you like focus your eyes just right, this amazing 3D image comes into. Have you guys seen these things? And the Grateful Dead's a lot like that. You know, you could be like, if you're not really kind of initiated into it, it's like, oh, those are, I guess, some nice dots, you know. But if you see it right, you know, there's this amazing 3D image. And it really, I can say without question, like, you know, experiencing, you know, that, I guess you could call it spiritual reality with the Grateful Dead is 100% why I practice. You know, I'm, never say never, but I can't imagine a path or a scenario where I would have practiced without that. And I spent the next, you know, 2 or 3 years seeing many Grateful Dead concerts. And I, you know, and every time I'd go, I just, you know, it was like an onion being peeled, just infinite depth of just kind of opening up to whatever that reality was. And, you know, and most of my friends were not aware of this aspect of the dead. They were just going for the party and stuff. And I tried explaining it to them, and they'd be like, you're weird, you know. But occasionally I'd meet, like, people in the audience and stuff who would get it, and we'd talk about it. And I remember there was kind of came to, you know, kind of a height. There's a, it's about a year and a half later, and the Grateful Dead were playing Mountain View, California, the Bay Area. And is just one of those nights where they were just kind of on from the get-go. And you know, normally, so, you know, the Grateful Dead, they play a first set of a lot of just kind of standard structured songs with a little bit of jamming towards the end of the set. And then there'd be an intermission that often was way too long. And then they come back for the second set. And that, you just, and normally they'd play like three to five songs, and then the drummers would do like this drumming solo, and then the drummers would go do whatever they do, and then the musicians would come and play the spacey music, and then they'd play like four more songs and intermission. So that's the kind of the standard structure for Grateful Dead's set. But this year, this night, Jerry just wouldn't leave the stage for drums, you know, just, and the music was just so good. And, you know, just Jerry wouldn't leave. It was like a very, you know, unusual show, and just kind of built, you know, this 40-minute, just formless, just incredible music. And then, you know, and then they kind of went into this chaotic space, like Mickey Hart, the percussionist, he has this instrument called the beam, and just creates these really just thunderbolt, you know, thunder-type sounds. And out of it, they drop in this song called China Doll, and it was just so beautiful. And it, like at that moment, I mean, it's, I can truly say it was like just an overwhelming spiritual experience. And like kind of the song ends with the lyrics, singing a little bit, and it basically goes, you know, pick up your China doll, it's only fractured, just a little nervous from the fall. And like for that moment, it was almost like I'd heard that lyrics 1,000 times, but you know, almost like a koan, like something opened up, and it was like, it dawned on me, like, you know, human beings are inherently whole spiritual beings, but we're just kind of fractured from the fall, from that state. And, you know, and the goal of humans are to, you know, kind of patch through that fracture. And it was just, I mean, it was just such a profound moment. You know, and I saw the Grateful Dead for a few more years, and more of these crazy experiences. And I had some experiences that I think were, like, legitimately, objectively kind of, yeah, supernatural, or, you know, I won't go into this so you don't think I'm crazy, but, you know, it definitely let me know that there's kind of more going on than just this physical reality. But one thing that was very clear was, these experiences were just glimpses that there's a possibility. Like, it didn't give me anything, you know, to take back into the world. I mean, it made me, you know, it was, and so I felt like I need to do a real spiritual practice, you know, and I looked at shamanism, And then I was visiting my grandma again in Idaho, and I went to the library there, and I checked out a book called Three Pillars of Zen. And I read through that, and you know, and there's that famous Enlightenment chapter section that you know, the teacher of this place hates profoundly. But you know, I was reading through those Enlightenment experiences, and I thought, you know, this is what I experienced at the Grateful Dead, but this is real. So, and it made me. You know, really, and so like all the different spiritual stuff I looked at, Zen was the one that seemed like directly, you know, it wasn't I hadn't really been to a Zen center yet, so I didn't know how much ritual there actually was, but, you know, but it seemed like it was like authentic, and it was all about the, you know, having the direct experience with, you know, I guess you call it your true self or whatever. And I'm like, well, Zen, you know, Zen just seemed like the cut to the chase, you know. And then, you know, soon I wound up in Humboldt County and for college, and I was going to the co-op there, and there was a advertisement for a half-day sitting with the Arcata Zen Group, and I'm like, oh, there we go. You know, I could finally do this. So I went there, and Maylee Scott was the teacher there then. I don't know if, did you know Maylee at the Berkeley Zen Center? She's since passed away from cancer, but she was a teacher up there for a while, and she's Mel Weitzman student. So she was the first Zen priest I'd ever met. I was like, is she enlightened? And so I sat this half-day sitting, and that was only moderately painful. I can do this. So I called Green Gulch and said, like, and, you know, and Three Pillars Zen, all the narrative things that, you know, people sit these sessions, and they have a kensho, and they're enlightened. So I'm like, well, I'll go sit a session, you know. And so I called Green Gulch and somehow talked them to let me, I don't know if it was a 5 or 7 day session, but so my second time, I think it was a 7 day session. And I realized in very much retrospect, who's your teacher's name? I'm spacing. No, currently. Meow, yeah, I don't know. So Meow, we've at Edoxon, we realized he was actually the person who was like kind of my handler at that session. And I'd always wondered, like, what happened to that priest? And now I know. But so this was like 1992 or so, so I was just, it was a horrible, because I had no daily sitting practice at all. I mean, my entire previous Zen was experience of Zen was a half day sitting, I think, with 20-minute sittings. And back then, the sessions had a harder schedule. I think it was something like 14, 40-minute sessions a day. Yeah. And it just, it within the first 2 hours, there was no spiritual attempt. It was just survival, you know. And as I remember thinking that 7 day, oh, and it was kind of a weird session because even though it was a Green Gold session, they were fixing their Zendo, so it was actually held at City Center. And I remember it felt so weird. I was like in this place and like the world was going on outside and it just seemed so like, like fast. And I remember like from the passage of time, it felt like a couple months, like without exaggeration, like those 7 days were like for now what would probably feel like 5 months, And I got out of there. One thing that surprised me, I was really profoundly struck by the services and the chanting and to my surprise. And I remember looking at Rev Anderson, like, is he enlightened? He has intense eyes. So then I went back home and I spent the next 3 summers kind of being a raft guide in the summer, kind of floating around school. And then, and I read a lot of Zen. And the stories that really struck me were Bankai, am I pronouncing that right? And then Hakuin. There's just intense ascetic effort, that they spent in their lives, and then culminated with, profound awakening. I'm like, well, that's what I need to do. I'm going to become a monk. And, like I had no aspirations for a career or anything, And so I kind of broke up with my girlfriend and she drove me down. I looked at Green Gulch and Sonoma Mountain Zen Center. And I visited both. And Sonoma Mountain Zen Center was very just picturesque, very remote. Like just aesthetically, I really liked it. So I chose that place. And so I was on the go. I mean, and I thought that was it. I was entering the, I was gonna be a poor monk and die homeless. I lasted there, and the teacher, he so when I got there, I guess he'd come down. He was sick, so I think I did one or two Dokusans with him the whole 6 months I was there. So I'd signed up for a year. But he was just never around, and so I got really good at sitting, because they're very sitting heavy there. I think there's 6 40-minute periods of session during a practice period, and when a session would roll around, you're already sitting so much it hardly seemed like a change, And I got really was able to really maintain like a pretty powerful samadhi. But the community. I felt really dysfunctional without like the leadership of a teacher, and if you ever lived in a small spiritual community, it's like, at like work, you hang out with people you would never hang out with otherwise, but you get to go home from them, but you're like living with these people, and it's like there's the angry guy, the blind guy, the confused guy, the old, then like one of the people, I don't know if he lived there or he just came around a lot. I remember he's since become probably what's the most famous spiritual teacher in America, kind of the non-dual tradition. But I remember talking to him. He's, one of my fellow students. I remember we were like discussing some spiritual point. He's like, "You know what? I have lots of attainment and you don't, so you have no room to talk." I'm like, "All right, conversation is over." And so I was not that surprised. And then one time, a friend wanted me to go to the spiritual talk, and I'm sitting in the audience. And I'm like, "Where do I know that guy? Spiritual attainment dude, And I kind of read up on his history, and he was actually there at the same time I was. But so I wasn't surprised he became a guru. But he's good at it. He's very charismatic. So after about 6 months there, it felt really wrong. And I just at a visceral level did not feel like a right place to be. I think I made it through two practice periods. And at the end of the second practice period, I just knew it was time to go. And someone else had left halfway, my stay there, and all these meetings and talking and crying. I'm like, I'm just going to disappear. So I called my friend in Arcade. I'm like, you need to come pick me up in the middle of the night. So I made my room, cleaned my room, left a real nice letter on my pillow, and just bailed. And, which I guess is a little cowardice, but it just felt like I didn't want to have 1,000 meetings about it, you know. And they wrote me lots of nice letters saying, you're always welcome back. It's great, you know. So, I mean, it wasn't like bad vibe leaving. And then from there, my friend and I, we decided to start a game, like a computer game company. Because it turned out I was had some talent in programming. So that brought me to North Carolina. And that kind of fizzled out. So I went back to school for College of the Redwoods. And there was no center nearby. So I kind of stopped sitting too much. And that lasted, I guess, 2 years, 3 years. You know, I occasionally sit. I spent a lot of time in nature. That was kind of... Then I moved to the Bay Area for a programming gig at AT&T in San Ramon. And I was next to Zen Centers again, so I started sitting regularly. And the second book I ever read was Charlotte Jocko Beck's Everyday Zen, which is a great book if you haven't read it. And I was going to Berkeley Zen Center, I was going to Green Gulch Lawton City Center, but I found out like Charlotte Jocko Beck had a local Dharma room. I'm like, oh, cool. And so I went, and so she had a little Zendo at the kind of in the little studio underneath her house up in the kind of the nice part of Oakland. And, you know, and it felt like a good place for me. You know, I liked the simplicity of it, and I liked that it was in Charlotte Jocko Beck's lineage. So I sat there for a couple years, and, you know, and I'd go to, I'd sit a lot, and then I'd earned enough money where I could take a little vacation from work. So I had the startup that crashed spectacularly, and I was really kind of tired. And so I just wanted to scuba dive and sit for a year. So I took like a year and a half off work. I just went to like session after session after session, one day sittings. And I remember one time I told Diane I was going to a session at San Francisco Zen Center. She said, really? You know, like, and then so I actually started going like in secret, which was kind of weird, you know. Because like she didn't say not to, but I could tell, you know, she wasn't totally thrilled about it. So I thought, like, let's just don't ask, don't tell, you know. And I was sitting a lot, you know, definitely, and I wanted to, you know, accomplish something. And I remember there was one session, it's a 3-day session, and I can't remember what part of it, but I remember, like, I went to Doku-san with her, and the Charlotte Jocko Beck lineage comes from Maizumi Roshi, which is kind of a mix of Rinzai and Soto. So it's like the forms, and a lot of the forms are Soto. But Maizumi Roshi is a very koan-focused study. But then Jocko Beck broke off because, you know, Maizumi did a lot of horrible things to her and her family. And she kind of dropped the koan, but she kept the intense, like in that lineage, you have a very intense relationship with the teacher. You go to a Doku-san every sitting, you know, or at least you can, and most people do. And, you know, and if you go to that center, you're a student of that teacher. You don't just kind of go there to sit, you know, which is very different than the San Francisco Zen Center lineage. I really like being able to go to, like, Green Gulch and just disappear and not have to, like, talk, you know, not have to, like, explain who I am. And, you know, I really like that open aspect of it. But anyway, so I had a very intense relationship with Diane. But I really wanted to, you know, I wanted to accomplish, you know, I wanted to make, you know, level up and practice. And I remember I had a Doku-san. She's like, how are things going? I'm like, great, you know, and kind of lied, you know, because I wanted to impress her and make her think that, you know, I was, you know, making progress in her practice. And she's like, oh, that's good to hear. Doing, you know, rang me out of there, like totally saw through my bullshit, you know. So I went back to my cushion and I was like, oh, I'm such a, you know, what am I doing? And like, I really, for the first time in my life, like just truly just sat and, you know, and I mean, and I really had no ambition. You know, I was kind of ashamed of my gain-seeking mind, and I just really just kind of surrendered, you know, like like totally surrendered, you know, and like didn't want to get anywhere. I just sat. And then the session ended. I went home. And then there was, we had a normal Monday sitting. So I went to the next Monday sitting. And I remember during the sitting, like I was still kind of in that surrender mode. And like while I was sitting, I felt like this chunk of ice break off, like emotional ice break off. And I kind of float up. And I just had this really intense emotion, like all like, I felt like a decade of emotion just was released. And I was crying on the cushion. And I just felt really light. And then Diane was going to Europe for like 6 weeks or something to lead sessions there. So I'm like, bye, Diane. Have a nice vacation. And so this next part, I wasn't sure whether I was going to tell you guys this, but I guess I need to put all my cards on the table. So I was driving to work after the sitting, and it was like just really intense rain. And I was like really taut because, like, you know, I couldn't see where I was going. And like, it's like every time I changed land, I would hope there was no semi there. And, you know, finally, so I got to Crow Canyon Road where I, you know, the exit to go up to San Ramon where I worked. And I get off the freeway and like the rain stops and I get to the bottom. And like, it sounds like I'm making this up, but like the rain stopped and there are all these like rays of lights coming through the clouds. And I had some thought like, about Dogen and original enlightenment or something, and like, wham! Like the whole world snapped into focus, and I felt this. It was about 15 years before I was really able to talk to this with, about other people, but I felt this like, I guess you could call it God, you know, this infinite, like crystalline purity. It's like, just like, you know, just clearly the core basis of the universe in existence. And I mean, I can't say I felt it. It was, you know, I wasn't, you know, there was no experiencing. It was just, you know, just so, I mean, the purity is the word I could best describe it. You know, everything, and it wasn't like dreamy and out of focus. It was like such infinite, like everything was super clear. And then, like, the light turns green, and I'm like, oh, I got to drive, I guess, or drive and drove itself. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm having an enlightening. So my dualistic brain started kicking back in almost immediately. I'm like, oh, I'm having an enlightenment experience. Like, oh, my God. And so I pulled over so I wouldn't crash. And I thought, like, oh, like, fundamentally, there's nothing wrong. There are no problems. I just knew it at the deepest core of my being. I'm like, oh, well, enlightenment's real, you know? And so I drove to work, and I remember sitting, and it's kind of embarrassing in retrospect, I remember, like, sitting in the parking lot, like, well, I have to save all beings now, you know? Like, how am I going to bring everyone to this date, you know? I get to work, and I literally, like, I'm dancing through the hallways, just, you know, I'm so light, and I remember I'm at my cubicle, and there's, like, literally, like, a crowd of, like, 20 people, like, gathered around my cubicle. It's like, what's wrong with you, you know? And then my one friend's like, did you get laid? You know, but people were drawn to me. Like, they just wanted to be around me, you know. And I'm usually super cranky in the morning, and no one wants to be around me before noon. But, like, and then, like, you know, finally everyone dispersed, and I just felt so clean and pure. And I spent all morning cleaning. I couldn't stop cleaning. I felt clean, and I wanted everything around me to be clean. But slowly I noticed as the day was going on, there started to be problems again, you know, and by the end of, and then I had a Vegas trip planned. So me and my roommate went to Vegas, and I just remember just, and to this day, if I'm around like slot machines and stuff, it kind of brings me back just because like, the whole world was just breathing, like just thusness, you know, like, and so it was kind of like an afterglow. But within, I'd say, you know, 48 hours, it was like it never happened. And I was totally back to my old self, and which was really upsetting. And because I totally thought it would be permanent, because like that's just obviously how reality, like it wasn't like an altered state of reality, it was like all the filters were taken off and I was seeing reality how it really was. And then those filters were back and I was just like, God damn it, you know. And around that time I was kind of reading Shoes Outside the Door. Has anyone read that book? Which doesn't present the very best look at practice, you know. And I was thinking, like, all these people are sitting and they're still having all these their whole lives and they're still having all these problems. And I'm like, And I start thinking, like, you know, because, like, there's a lot of religions that I think, as an outsider looking in objectively, they're not right, you know. Like, there is no Zulu that brought the souls in a volcano. And, you know, like, these people are clearly deluding themselves. But I thought, like, well, I was practicing a real path. I'm like, well, maybe I'm deluding myself, too. Maybe practice is bullshit. And, you know, people have these experiences, and they trick themselves into thinking they're permanent. You know, and they're like, oh, I'm enlightened now. You know, but I just, like, I couldn't do that. And what really made it difficult was Diane was gone, so I couldn't talk to her about, you know, this is before cell phones and really even that ubiquitous email. And so, I had no one to talk to about this. And I became super discouraged with practice and, you know, and the shoes outside the door. And then I was on the board of the Bay Zen Center, and we had to, like, vote our new resolution in. And the resolution was that, you know, Diane basically had almost dictatorial powers. I'm probably exaggerating, but, and I mean, Diane, if you've ever met her, is literally the sweetest, most selfless person in the world. I mean, there's no one I would trust more to be a dictator than Diane. But like, having just read Shoes Outside the Door, I couldn't bring myself to vote for this resolution. And so I took the, once again, I took the brave way out and just disappeared. And plus, I had gotten a new relationship. So I moved to Sacramento. And I remember Diane had told me once that, you know, the hardest part about being a teacher is you build these really intense relationships with these students, but then they just disappear. And I'm like, oh, I did that to her. And so I moved to Sacramento, and then I started getting into music again. There's this band called Railroad Earth. And I caught them, and even just seeing them sober, like, I kind of got that same, like, kind of spiritual resonance with them. So me and my wife started going to a lot of these Railroad Earth concerts, and Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead started picking up and playing. His music was very, very good, kind of approaching what the Grateful Dead could do. So I was kind of getting spiritually nourished by music again. So I kind of filled the void of sitting. And plus, you know, I came and I visited you guys when you were over at the yoga studio near Elvis. And I think, like, oh, there's no teacher here or something like that. You know, so I didn't really come around. Like, I was looking for a teacher, not really just a sitting group. And then I just kind of got caught up in life. And, you know, and I probably went, like, 3 years without sitting or something. And then it got to the point where, you know, I had kids and, you know, all the stress with the money. I got a house we couldn't really afford. It was stressful. I remember one night I went to this wine tasting, and I got really into wine as a hobby. I went to this wine tasting, and I really dehydrated, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and I felt, like, dizzy and thirsty, and in a half-sleep state, I thought, like, oh, I'm having a panic, no, I'm having a heart attack, which kicked off a panic attack, which, if you've ever had one, has the wonderful ability to mimic a heart attack, which becomes this downward spiral, and I, like, truly thought I was dying, you know, and, you know, I called 911, you know, I called the Kaiser, and they're like, oh, you're probably just having a panic attack, but come in if you, you know, call 911 if you're, and so I was like living in like such in a, like panic for like a week. And then finally they prescribed me some Xanax, and that made all the panic go away. So I'm like, oh, okay, I'm not dying. And my friend was a doctor. He's like, come in, I'll hook you up for EKG. And, you know, I was fine. And, you know, that helped too. But I mean, I'd felt like to go from the height of, you know, that experience, you know, with the clouds and so forth to like, literally, like, I remember being in the grocery store just shaking with anxiety. You know, I just, like, I was ashamed at myself, like, to have gone from, like, I had come to this low, you know. And then when my kids got, and my kids got a little older, you know, I started being able to come here, and I saw a few other places. Kind of gave koan practice kind of a few false starts, but didn't work out. And I think in the long run, I think Soto is more my speed in a lot of ways. So I start sitting again. And one thing I would notice, which wasn't the case prior to taking the break, especially after like a one day sitting, but sometimes even after one sitting, like when I get, never when I'm on the cushion, but when I get up and kind of go out into the world, like whatever I experienced that day, driving to work, I feel kind of like I hook back into. And it's not like I'm like, it's not like an altered state of reality or something. It's just like becoming aware of just like, you know, purity, I guess. And, but what I really wrestle with is like, is that true nature? And I'm like hooking back into it. Or is that just one of the visionary states that Zen teachers warn you not to get caught up on? But I mean, it feels like coming home, you know? So it's really hard not to, kind of nurture it a little bit. Yeah, and, you know, because, I mean, it feels like, you know, I talked about, like, that sixth sense of, like, being aware of spirituality. I mean, it's, like, I feel like a sense is opening up. And if I stop sitting, it goes away. Like, you know, about 8 weeks ago, I broke my foot and ankle. I sprained my ankle really bad and broke my foot. So I couldn't sit cross-legged. And I just, sitting in a chair just was not working for me, which, I, you know, it should have been a practice opportunity, but I kind of chickened out. And, but, you know, that, I don't feel, so the last 8 weeks, I haven't felt that at all, you know. So it's like, I really need to sit, you know. And, but, you know, Soto, like, definitely feels home to me. I like the, I really like, so, you know, like, I've gone up and I sat at a Rinzai place up in Humboldt County a couple times. And, you know, like, one, like, it's that's a lot of times much too fast for me. I remember one time I was sitting there. It was, like, the first block of a session. Usually the weird stuff happens at the end of the session or after, but like this is like literally the first block. I'm sitting there and like these crickets in this valley are just immensely loud, like a 747 engine. And for, you know, like poof, for a second, like I have like no separation with the crickets. And you think, well, that's great, right? But it was actually terrifying. And, you know, and I, it kind of made me, and like I was having like, like, if you ever sat at a Rinzai temple, like, they're really good at samadhi, and it's, like, the whole place is, like, a pressure cooker, and if you chant wrong, they'll stop chanting and yell at you, and, you know, it's, like, you know, it's like, so it's just a really intense vibe, and I was, like, having all these hallucinations, and I was, like, yeah, this is too much too fast, you know, and so, like, I like the more organic unfolding of Soto, I think, than the more pressure cooker of, like, the traditional koan practice, but I mean, but sometimes I worry that I'm kind of maybe leaving some money on the table. Like, am I settling? You know, because like I definitely, one thing I don't feel like I have is like kind of like the great matter of life and death. You know, why are we here? You know, what's the meaning of life? Like, you know, kind of my Grateful Dead experiences and my Crow Canyon experience kind of seem to point that human beings can see clearly and answer those questions. And I feel like I haven't. And so sometimes I wonder if like, am I being too lackadaisical in my practice, and I'm not really putting all my money on the table to really answer those questions? But then again, I don't want to go crazy. So that's my story. If anyone has any questions or complaints, yeah.
And I came to this heretical realization that I think that the Jerry Garcia Band is better than the Grateful Dead. And that's all I have to say.
From an experiential standpoint, I would say so. Like, the Grateful Dead was this crazy experiment. You know, I'd say it was 50% evil and 50% good, you know, and it could go either way at any moment. I remember one time I opened a porta potty and this, like, old man had a stick in the needle in this little teenage girl's arm. I mean, like, there's some darkness at the Grateful Dead, you know, sometimes the energies felt maybe not great, you know, but where Jerry Garcia Band was definitely more of a, felt like a big musical hug, you know. You know, like, felt safer of an experience. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, he has the mic, sorry.
Oh, I don't need the mic.
Okay. Well, I think you're supposed to.
I hate to kind of focus on the music, but you were so passionate about the way the music affected you, and I just want to run this by, like, my analogy uh-huh. of listening to the Grateful Dead is that I always felt it was very organic, mm-hmm. and it would start off, and I always, like, my analogy is that it was like a jalopy, mm-hmm. and it would kind of, like, herk and jerk a little, and it was tough going through the gears, and then at some point it would just congeal
totally
and just be just like a drummer hitting different things. It would all be happening, and it was very spacious music. And I think, like, I think you, and I'm not like a super Grateful Dead fan, but you could get sucked into that thing where you're just feeling all these, the spatial, organic connection of it, and then it'll kind of wind down and fall apart. So it had this like real ebb and flow, and I think that's, you know, I wonder how you feel about that.
Oh yeah, I mean, you've nailed it. And Jerry Garcia, you know, if he got the right interviewer, like, he would kind of open up about the spiritual aspect sometimes, and he didn't like to, because everyone, because like when you're playing his music, like, it felt like God was going through him, and some people thought like, oh, Jerry's God, and, you know, and he didn't like that. And so he was very, later in his career, he was very reluctant to talk about spirituality, because, like, just so many weirdos deified him and stuff. And but sometimes he would open up, and he'd be honest, like, we're not doing it. It's happening to us, you know. And he says, every time we play, we have to relearn how to play, you know, play as a band. And sometimes, so it's like they would get up there and just, you know, they would do their mechanical thing. And sometimes the spirit would rise up, and sometimes it wouldn't. But it always would take, you know, they would have to rediscover it every night, you know. So it was very organic, and, you know, and like sometimes, you know, and sometimes they'd get that groove in the first songs, and some shows I saw they never did, you know.
I'd like to offer, because I was really interested in your, when you started talking about your spiritual practices and your highs and lows, to me, like, my first association is like the metaphor of the Grateful Dead, the jalopy. It's hitting on all cylinders sometimes. Sometimes it's like ecstasy. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it stalls in the middle of traffic. You know, and in a certain sort of way, when you were talking about your experiences, that's what I was thinking of, you know. It's like, you know, it's always...
I really changed the oil, which is not good. Did you?
It sounds like a lot of you were taking the same chemicals. No, I wanted to ask you about this super kaleidoscopic chemical that you were using. Do you still use it?
No. I've basically been sober since my daughter was born 9 years ago. Not out of choice. I feel like, you know, if I even drink a beer, I kind of feel like it kind of covers up my, I don't want to say true nature, because that sounds so arrogant, but, like, I feel like I'm polluting my natural. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's some times where I'll, like, especially if I'm rafting and I get off the river, there's nothing that tastes better than an IPA, you know. But, like, I don't drink to intoxication. I just, and not because I think it's bad, or, I mean, I don't like being around drunk people anymore, but, like, I feel like what I have is enough. I don't need to add to it. And I feel like it kind of takes away a little bit. And I don't judge it, and I'm, you know, and I miss the intellectual aspects of wine and collecting stuff, but, I mean, I just feel like it's polluting to some degree. And not judgmentally, it's just how it feels, you know. Yeah, so I have no desire to alter my consciousness anymore.
So you don't think that your consciousness was altered? Do you think that it went back to its natural state after you stopped using?
So, I mean, psychedelics are kind of weird because they do lots of things at the same time. And 1% of maybe 1% of the experiences people can have it, it seems to open something in the brain, right? But that's at the same, but that might be at the same time they're being eaten by a dragon. So, like, my experience is most people who do psychedelics don't have a genuine spiritual experience with it. And most of my experiences were not spiritual either. You know, they were just interesting, you know. But I think occasionally the clouds can part. And, but I think the best is what it gives you is it gives you an inkling that something's there that you can maybe, chase. I don't say chase, but, you know, you can investigate. But I also think they're really dangerous. I've seen people go crazy on them. Like, I had a roommate who, he found a vial of a powder on the ground, thought it was cocaine, and ended up taking like 1,000 hits by accident. And he wound up in an insane asylum. I mean, so it's, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to anyone, especially, certainly not children or teenagers. But, you know, if you're a healthy adult, you know, you're at High Sierra Music Festival, I mean, maybe. But it's, I mean, so it's a mixed bag.
See, you answered my third question without me even asking it. I was going to ask you, would you recommend that I try some?
I mean, I think the danger is too great. I mean, like one thing I've noticed is, like time in nature. I think like extended time in nature. I think can open this tickle the same switches in the brain. I think that's a safer, more organic way to experience the same sort of thing. I think I could, in good faith, recommend anyone take psychedelics. And like I said, they don't give you anything. They just give you a sense that maybe something's there, you know. I mean, but you could say the same thing for Kensho experiences in Zen. I mean, they don't change you. They just give you a sense that there's something to... I mean, they change you in the sense that you realize that nothing's maybe real as you thought it was. But you still, you're still you. You still have all your same problems. You know, you realize there's something to nurture. So in that sense, even Zen... organic spiritual experiences in Zen are, in and of themselves, actually have no use, I think. It's just, they give you a sense that there's a possibility of nurturing something in your life. Okay.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, I was going to ask you just maybe to reflect upon some points from the talk.
Okay.
You were talking about at the end how, excuse me, maybe you were leaving some money on the table because you weren't kind of maybe giving it your all.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also kind of talked about these moments of, you know, just sitting without attainment after that experience with the teacher, kind of seeing through your ruse.
Mm-hmm.
And the even from a musical perspective, saying that, you know, this kind of stuff is just happening to us and coming through us.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered if you could elaborate a little more on kind of just your personal take on what feels authentic towards moving towards a like a real enlightenment path.
Yeah. So I think the difference is, so I think waking up requires a degree of vulnerability. And I think, you know, we all have our... psychological traumas, light and great, and depending on our paths. And I think, you know, I think the path of spirituality, like, I think we all get into practice because we want to feel good. Like, we feel bad, and we hear, like, oh, Buddhism says life is suffering, and you can get rid of suffering. Like, oh, I can feel good from practice. You know, I think a lot of people get into practice because they want, you know, they want to feel better, right? And I think what practice really presents to you is at some point you realize wanting to feel better is the problem, you know? And so, like, you know, and so we're so hardwired from a biological point to want to, like, chase the endorphins and push away the pain that and for most people, it never even crosses their mind that you wouldn't do that, because why would you want to feel bad? You know, why wouldn't you want to feel good? But, you know, at a certain point in your practice, you realize that you really wanting to feel good and not feel bad is the problem, and it requires a degree of bravery and willingness to be vulnerable that I think, at least for me, I think is sometimes more than I can take at any given moment, because there's just no armor, you know, and so sitting a lot and developing a the muscle of samadhi kind of helps that, but also just being willingness to be vulnerable. I think, you know, if it moves too quickly, too fast, I think it is maybe more harmful than good, you know, from a psychological, because, you know, we have a spiritual development, but we're also psychological beings, right? And I think a smart practice, and I think Zen might almost be unique in the world where it's not about the enlightenment experience. It's about how do you manifest enlightenment in your life, right? And Zen's really good at that. And but you need to balance you know, if you think of the 10 ox herding pictures, you at some point, there's not even an ox, there's just, whatever it is, but if you keep reading the ox herding pictures, you're going back to the marketplace. And so there's, at some point there needs to be an integration of the psychological self with the true self, right? And that balance, and that's, and Zen's always presented of, treat your anxiety, or at least mindfulness is like treat your anxiety. But practice could be unbalancing. And I think a lot of people, I spent your time at Zen centers, and you'll see people, they'll come and they'll practice, they'll be really motivated, and then they'll disappear. And I think a lot of what makes people stop practicing, especially people that were kind of good at it, was they realized this isn't to feel better. I need to really be willing to not feel good, to truly be vulnerable. And I think at that fulcrum for a lot of people is when they stop practicing. It can even be psychologically damaging to them. And I know I there's times in my life I have more ability to endure that. I don't know if endure is the right word, but more ability to be vulnerable, and other times I'm not. And so this is kind of a long-winded answer, sorry. But I think if you throw open the doors too fast and too much, I think the psychological self is, which has its traumas, right? And just being alive and knowing you're going to die in itself is kind of a trauma, And I think it can be unbalanced and can a lot of times practice can, when you really get to kind of that fulcrum point, I think can be unhealthy from a psychological standpoint and break people sometimes. Okay.
Okay, so in good koan fashion, what is practice?